9 out of 10 hiring managers are having difficulty hiring today. Robert Half is here to help. At Robert Half, we know talent. Visit roberthalf.com today.
Hey, What's News listeners? It's Saturday, November 11th. I'm Anne-Marie Fertoli.
And I'm Luke Vargas for The Wall Street Journal. And the two of us are here this weekend to answer some questions, your questions, actually, about the war between Israel and Hamas.
All this week, we've been asking you, our What's News listeners, what you want to know about the conflict.
And we got a lot of questions about the situation on the ground in Gaza and the wider ramifications of the war.
And so we've been reaching out to our colleagues at The Wall Street Journal to get some answers.
All right, let's get right to it.
Many of you want to know what's happening on the ground in the Gaza Strip. And to answer your questions, I'm joined now by Shandy Race, our Deputy Bureau Chief for the Middle East. Let's start with a question that many have had since the start of this war, and that is how global intelligence failed to foresee Hamas's attack. Here's Isaac Ganado from Salt Lake City, Utah.
My question revolves around the intelligence failure following the attack on Israel by Hamas. There was reporting on the high-tech fence on the border with Gaza, as well as reports that the invasion was planned at least a year in advance. How did the Israeli intelligence and the existing defense infrastructure fail to forewarn the attack?
Shandy, your response?
That is the million-dollar question. I think everybody in Israel and around the world is asking that same question. It's certainly a question that Israelis are asking of their own government, and there's a lot of anger over how they could have allowed something like this to happen. We don't have all the answers yet. What I can tell you is that there was a very strong belief in Israel that it was in a new era, that it was in an era where it was on the cusp of making peace with its Arab neighbors, and that the Palestinian issue was sort of less and less relevant. They viewed Iran as a threat. They definitely view Hezbollah as a threat. But they thought that Hamas was contained. And I would also say that Hamas was sort of very much calculated in the way that they made the Israelis believe that Hamas was actually in some ways an entity that you could talk to, that you could negotiate with. And they had obviously been completely tricked. I am almost certain that there will be commissions that will investigate all of this, and much more specifics will come out about the level of failure. But at this point, we don't know a ton of specifics.
The Israel-Hamas war surpassed the one-month mark this week. According to health authorities in Hamas-run Gaza, thousands of people have been killed there, most of them women and children. Those figures don't distinguish between militants and civilians. But some of our listeners are asking, what else can the IDF, the Israel Defense Forces, do other than what it's already doing to protect civilians as it tries to root out Hamas? Here's Tal Sassover from Tel Aviv.
How can we fight Hamas hiding behind civilian population, underneath hospitals and schools, without harming the citizens in Gaza?
So it's obviously one of the hardest questions. What are the rules of war? And how does a military determine how many civilian casualties are acceptable? I don't think anyone thinks civilian casualties are not allowed. The question is really, what is the value of the military target in proportion to the number of civilian casualties? Israel has said that it's trying to avoid civilian casualties, but at the same time, there's a lot of concern from human rights groups who are saying that civilian casualties are astronomical and that they're alleging or appearing to allege that Israel is sort of crossing that line from an acceptable number of civilian casualties to an unacceptable number of civilian casualties. It is true that Israel has tried very hard to urge people to move to the south. There are multiple problems with that. One is that the south may be safer, but it's not necessarily safe. Hamas operating from a very densely packed area, which is full of civilians, this makes this war incredibly challenging for Israel. The question really is how they take those precautions and in what proportion to the military targets.
Let's turn to reaction in the Middle East. And obviously, this is a very divisive time. Mike Brodigam, an American living in Tallinn, Estonia, feels like a big segment of Israel's population is being excluded.
Last I checked, the population of Israel was 21% plus Israeli Arab. Is there a reason that when we talk about Israelis, 21% plus of the population is completely excluded from the conversation?
It's a fair point. There's definitely been a lot of talk about the Jewish segment of Israeli society, but as our listener has noted, there is 20% of the population are Arabs. And in fact, there were many Arab citizens of Israel who were killed on October 7th. There are Arab citizens of Israel who were taken hostage. And there are Arab citizens of Israel who are now fighting in Gaza as soldiers for the IDF. So there is really a range of responses from the Israeli Arab community. We ourselves have written about the feeling among many Israeli Arabs who identify as Palestinians, who feel very caught right now in this moment. On the one hand, they are Israeli citizens. On the other hand, they also very much sympathize and identify with the Palestinians who are suffering in Gaza. They are opposed to Israel's occupation in the West Bank, and so they have a very conflicted relationship with Israel. Some of them have said in the wake of the October 7th attack that they feel more Israeli, but at least the ones that we have spoken to feel very scared right now. They feel like they are being lumped in with the Palestinians in Gaza and with Hamas. And when they show support for Palestinians in Gaza, they're being unfairly accused of supporting terrorism. We've reported on people losing their jobs for social media posts, people being afraid to leave their homes, afraid of retribution. And we've seen some examples of that in the Israeli press and on social media.
Shandy Race is our Deputy Bureau Chief for the Middle East. Shandy, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you.
Coming up, we'll zoom out a bit to answer your questions about the war's broader impact, both for the rest of the Middle East and for global business. That's after the break.
Robert Half research indicates 9 out of 10 hiring managers are having difficulty hiring. Robert Half is here to help. Our recruiting professionals utilize our proprietary AI to connect businesses with highly skilled talent. At Robert Half, we know talent. Visit roberthalf.com today.
Since the Hamas attacks of October 7th that sparked the war, world leaders have been concerned about the conflict widening to include other players in the Middle East. And here now to answer some questions from What's News listeners about this is Journal Chief Foreign Affairs Correspondent Yaroslav Trofimov. Yaro, let's jump right in. I want to play a clip from a listener who was curious about what would happen if things were to escalate.
Hi, my name is Grant Needham, and I'm from Louisville, Kentucky. And my question is, if this did break out into a larger regional conflict, of the countries in that area, which side would each country most likely tend to fall on? And for bigger powers across the globe, what kind of response are they having? Is it a similar response with the U.S., or is it more of, let's stay out of this?
A lot to get through there, Yaro, but let's take it in turn, shall we? Starting with whether and how regional powers potentially could take sides here. What can we see already?
Well, we have seen that Iran, which really aspires to be the dominant regional power, has been using its proxies all over the region to support Hamas to an extent. Countries like Saudi Arabia that has been talking to Israel, the United Arab Emirates that has an Israeli embassy, and Egypt, they have been hostile to Iran for a very long time. So they would certainly not side with Iran in any war. And having fought several wars with Israel, Egypt is committed to maintaining a peace treaty with Israel and diplomatic relations. Some of them, like Bahrain and Jordan, have recalled their ambassadors, but that's a temporary measure. And they have maintained the diplomatic relations and the peace treaties.
And then, Yaro, on the second part of that question, this is actually a nice overlap with reporting that you've done recently about how China and Russia have been capitalizing on the situation.
So China and Russia have refused to condemn Hamas by name, and they've been very strongly critical of the Israeli bombing campaign. And that is something that plays really well in the Global South, where sympathy for the Palestinian cause is very high. China, especially being economically prosperous and not burdened by a war like the one that Russia is embroiled in Ukraine, is really trying to position itself as the alternative model of development of society to a lot of those developing nations around the world.
All right, let's turn now to another question, Yaro, that a listener sent in. This is also about how Iran fits into the equation, and this was Ethan Chanin in Washington, D.C.
So how do you see American and Iranian relations going in the future, given the fact that they've played such a key role in attempting to destroy the U.S. ally, Israel, in the Middle East, and the fact that it's pretty clear that they are a hop, skip, and a jump, as someone on your podcast has said, to nuclearizing.
All right, Yara, so what about that? There has been considerable interest in trying to understand whether Iran has been supportive of Hamas's October 7th attack, whether they would push Hezbollah to get involved, as you mentioned. Does the state of Washington-Iran relations factor into that?
Well, I mean, the relations don't really exist. They exchange messages through intermediaries, and then Iranian proxies lob missiles at American bases in Syria and Iraq. The big question when this all started a month ago was whether Iran was prepared to open a multi-front war against Israel through its proxies, whether Hezbollah was going to get involved. And Hezbollah plays a very important role because it has a much more powerful missile arsenal than Hamas. So it could actually inflict real pain on Israel, shut down the airport, hit military bases. And it was kept in reserve by Iran as a deterrent against an Israeli or an American strike on Iran. So the question, as many in the region said, was will Iran lose its face or its arm? And so far it's losing its face and not using its arm, Hezbollah, for proper full-scale war that would destroy this deterrent.
Though Iranian resources could play a big factor, right, in maybe determining future actions, which brings me to a final question, Yaro, also on Iran, from Sean Rowland in Wauwatosa, Wisconsin. He was observing that the Israel-Hamas conflict has felt a bit like a proxy war between Iran and the West, with the West funding Israel and Iran funding Hamas. And he goes on to say, what drives Iran's economy? So, Yaro, I guess regardless of whether this is per se a proxy war, what about Iran's capabilities? Can they keep financing groups that are enemies of Israel?
Well, I mean, they certainly can and certainly do. Iran does have oil revenues. It's one of the major oil exporting countries in the world. And it doesn't take that much money to finance a group like Hamas, or even Hezbollah for that matter, though many people in Iran, the pro-democracy protesters in Iran, have been complaining about the fact that all this money goes to fund foreign militant groups instead of the Iranian people. As for the proxies, it's true that Israel receives some military aid from the U.S., but obviously Israel has its own independent policy, and the leverage that the U.S. has over the decisions of Israel is sometimes quite limited. Hamas depends very much on Iran.
I have been speaking with the Journal's chief foreign affairs correspondent, Yaroslav Trofimov. Yaro, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And to wrap things up, I want to get to another question about what the conflict means for economies and businesses more broadly. I'm joined now by our global editor of Heard on the Street, Spencer Jacob. Spencer, us being the Wall Street Journal, listeners did have questions about the financial impact of the Israel-Hamas war. Gabriel Kotzel from Flemington, New Jersey, wants to know about the implications of the conflict on private sector growth.
Which industries or actors or major businesses do you feel are potentially being hindered or harmed by the conflict? Or vice versa, do you think that there are some companies or private interests that are able to profit more as a result of the conditions created by the conflict?
So, Spencer, we've covered how defense companies stand to benefit from the conflict. Who else?
Yeah, I mean, defense is the classic thing that you think of when war crops up. And a basket of U.S. defense and aerospace stocks, and also a basket of international defense-related stocks, both rallied, and especially U.S. defense-related stocks, especially since Israel is a major purchaser of U.S. military hardware, things like missile defense systems, so companies like RTX, formerly known as Raytheon Corporation, Lockheed Martin, General Dynamics, all indirectly are expected to potentially pick up some business. And, you know, whenever you have this, it's not the actual sales that necessarily matter, but if someone's equipment proves especially useful in a conflict, then it's like a living, breathing advertisement for your product. The classic template, though, that people look to when there's any conflict in the Middle East is energy, because it's the, you know, source of the largest oil and gas reserves in the world. And people think back, as a matter of fact, it was exactly 50 years earlier, the Yom Kippur War, that led to a quadrupling of oil prices. As people may or may not remember, after the surprise attack on Israel in 1973, there was an oil embargo against the West by the Arab members of OPEC. And there's no sign that that's going to happen. You know, Iran has made some noises, but there's been no disruption to supply. And after a brief bump, a basket of oil and gas producers has actually basically been flat.
And on the other side of that, Spencer, who stands to lose, financially speaking, from a business perspective?
Well, one loser would be airlines and tourism. You know, whenever there's acts of terrorism in the world, people think twice about taking trips. And of course, then specifically trips to Israel. And a couple of U.S. airlines did specifically cite travel to Israel. But then more broadly, what some people don't know because they don't think of them as Israeli companies, there's a huge tech sector in Israel. And so you have companies that have their origin in Israel and have big operations in Israel. And then even U.S. companies have a lot of their R&D in Israel. And so those have taken some mild hits because Israel has called up a couple of 100,000 reservists and it's in a war. And so that is in the back of people's minds. The more Israeli the company, the more they've been hit.
That's global editor of Heard on the Street, Spencer Jacob. And that's it for this special edition of What's News.
Today's show was produced by Pierre Bien-Aimé, Anthony Bansi, Kate Bullivant, and Mohsen Ali, with supervising producers Michael Kosmides and Sandra Kilhoff, and deputy editors Scott Salloway and Chris Sinsley. I'm Luke Vargas.
And I'm Anne-Marie Fertoli. We'll be back with a new show on Monday morning. Thanks for listening.
This message comes from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, destination-focused dining, and cultural enrichment on board and on shore. And every Viking voyage is all-inclusive with no children and no casinos. Discover more at Viking.com.